I'll call the meeting to order. The Environment Natural Resources Committee, March 8, 2007. Has anyone had a chance to review the minutes for March 6th?
I have not, sir.
Representative Hoppe.
I remove the minutes.
Thank you, Representative. Hoppe moves the minutes for March 6th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Minutes are approved. We are going to be picking up today with the bill that we have been discussing last week, Representative Clark's bill, House File 934. We did lay it over, and we're going to wrap that up today. And I would ask that we're not going to have an open mic again. I think all the testimony for the open mic was provided last week. We will have an opportunity, however, to ask questions, and if somebody wants to call someone down from the audience, that is acceptable to have somebody testify to a question. And we will, with that, start off. First of all, I will move House File 934. So again, that is before us. This bill has been amended. The amendment has not been engrossed yet because the bill has not been passed. So you'll have to work off the bill and the amendment separately. But with that, Representative Clark, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for reviewing this bill again, and I just wanted to point out, I know there were people that had a few questions last time, and I wanted to point out that there are some additional packets in your documents in your packets that you can check out, and one of them deals with the alternative to DECA VDE. That was a question. People wanted to know what the alternatives were, and there's a whole packet on that that's put together by Mark Rossi, the research director from Clean Production Action. He's a fellow who's got a lot of credentials to go along with his name. His doctorate is in environmental policy from MIT, and he's written a number of very important research documents. So look that over. That does have the, hopefully answer some of your questions about the alternatives to DECA. That was part of the question. And I wanted to also indicate that since we last met, another state, Michigan, the Department of Environmental Quality there, has joined the two other states, both Maine and Washington, in recommending a DECA phase-out. That's the part of those states that are comparable to our own MPCA, and I think I indicated to you the last time a letter from our MPCA that talked about the answer to the question of whether or not DECA breaks down into the more toxic materials, and of course they said it does. So there's a number of things in there. There's a packet that's put together by the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy that goes over the issues again, getting the facts straight. And so, members, I hope that I've answered your questions and provided you with materials that would answer your questions. And if you have any more, I can try to answer.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Hoppe.
It's okay. Again, we're interchangeable. Representative Clark, I came into the last meeting thinking this was kind of a no-brainer and I'd support it, and I think at best it was a push. I mean, we had one group saying one thing and one group saying the other, and I'm not a science guy, and I was kind of at sea. Did you, between then and now, talk to the plastics people and the industry people and do some peace in the valley kind of work?
Representative Clark.
Well, one of the things I can say is we were citing, you know, quite different facts. You know, one of them was whether or not this compound breaks down, and the witness for the opposition basically said it does not. I provided for you information that it does. I mean, that's not really a negotiable item. That's not a peace in the valley kind of thing. Either it breaks down or it doesn't. It breaks down in sunlight. It breaks down in fires. It breaks down in many, many different ways. So I think there's some things that we're probably just not going to agree on, and I asked you to look at the science. I brought the documents to you. We had expert witnesses last week. I've given you some more expert witnesses with information here, and I just don't think we're going to agree on that. That's one of the main issues, I guess. And whether or not there are alternatives was another contention of the other side, and I provided you with a document that lists many alternatives and where they occur and which kind of materials and so on. So
Representative Hoppe.
I'll follow up on that. Well, I think what I was looking for in the piece in the Valley is you had your experts and they had their experts. I mean, the gentleman from RTP came and said they've been working with it for 25 years and no problems and no health problems with their employees. So, I mean, to me, the layman who doesn't know anything about the science, we have your experts and their experts. You know, I guess I was looking for something. You know, which experts do we believe?
Representative Park.
Can I hope you believe our own MPCA? I hope you believe the documents that I put before you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Park, you're actually kind of beating around the barn here. It, to me, trying to look at it, I didn't know anything about it when I came in, and looking at it from the last hearing, it looked like their testifier knocked the shoes right off of your testifier. It looked like she spoke with some authority and yours just quoted other people's studies, and the MPCA didn't look like they wanted to even get close to this. And the guy that came down stuttered and stammered and said, we've got concerns. Well, I've got concerns about my car. I've got concerns about my girlfriend. I mean, I got concerns about... I got concerns about everything. But that wasn't a strong statement at all for the PCA. And it just, I think they 2-1'd you on the testimony, and this is the best guess at best. Not best science, best guess.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested if other members of the committee feel the same way.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate Representative Hoppe's and Cornish's desire to be diligent, to exercise due diligence. That's what we're all here to do. But I have to say, quite frankly, I saw documentation presented by Representative Clark. I heard assertions made by opponents, particularly the first testifier. I didn't see any documentation. I didn't see any. I heard references to research that were never laid before me. We had three states that had done some levels of research, and those states admittedly said that there isn't 100% conclusiveness on every single issue, but I thought they were quite clear about the breakdown issue that is very much part of Representative Clark's concern here. And I also saw advice from those states that we do need to not do nothing, that we need to move in some. There's enough here, there's enough concern, particularly as these elements potentially continue to accumulate in our environment, that we ought to not wait until we reach a point where real damage is happening here. And so, you know, Representative Cornish, I appreciate where you're coming from, but quite frankly, I think you and I might have been in two different hearings, because I frankly didn't see that anywhere near the level of documentation presented by the first testifier. I certainly paid close attention to the producer up north, but it's my understanding that producer is also using alternatives in his product line. I'll stand to be corrected if that's not true. It seems to me that we can probably go around and around on this forever. However, I think we've got good science that would back some action on the part of this legislature to start drawing some kind of a fence around these kind of elements in our environment.
Any further questions or comments? Yeah, Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to remember it, and if I'm not mistaken, the gentleman up here in the audience might be the one that testified in Karen Clark's committee, and I'm wondering if we shouldn't hear that testimony again, unless I'm remembering the wrong individual.
Well, do you have a specific question for them, if we could maybe narrow it down to
specifically about the embedment in this chemical and the embedment in the plastic and how its ability to move from within the plastic. If I'm not mistaken, it was pretty strong testimony, if I remember hearing it.
Okay, would the gentleman, yes, you'd like to step forward, please, and state your name for the tape.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Mackey from the RTP company. And again, my testimony is, again, this, the dextrobromyl diphenyl oxide is a crystalline white powder material, very similar to a mineral type product. And when you encapsulate that, our RTP's job is to compound that into plastic. So we will disperse that within the polymer through a compounding operation. And once that material is encapsulated within the polymer, the material has very little ability to migrate out and get out of the polymer material. I mentioned that the only way they typically can get that out is with incineration of the material or solvents that would dissolve the polymer.
Thank you. And Representative Wagenius.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remembered a question I had for you last time, but we ran out of time. You testified, I believe, that Sony took DECA out of their products for branding reasons. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I did not testify about the Sony situation. I would not. That could have been the earlier testimony.
I thought you also repeated that testimony. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Clark.
Just one thing to keep in mind. You know, we're talking about protecting the public health from toxic flame retardants, and we're also talking about protecting the firefighters and others who are dealing with incinerated materials. I mean, the witness just mentioned that incineration is one of the ways that it is released. One of the things that we want to do is start phasing it out so our firefighters are not facing that kind of release into the atmosphere of the fires that they may have to fight. So, I mean, hopefully the witness doesn't disagree with that.
Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, two points. Representative Clark, I wanted you to comment because one of the issues that was raised last time was the question of regulation in Europe, and you have provided some evidence about that, but that was in contention between testifiers last time, so I thought it would be helpful if you summarized the evidence that you've submitted since on that.
Sure. There was a claim that that it's effectively that Europe hasn't phased it out. And if you look at number 3 on the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, we talked there about that DECA was temporarily exempted from this ROHS, Restriction of Hazardous Substances Directive, until 2010. That happened with a lot of pressure from apparently a lot of U.S. corporations. But it's now restricted as of June in electronics because it's contaminated with some other PVDEs. And there's some impurities. Nona BDE, I guess, is the main one. And it exceeds what is allowed by the European Commission in their restriction on hazardous substances. So it's effectively phased out there, too. Okay. That's number 3 if you need to go over that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bryan.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up by referring members to the same this Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy document, number 2, that cites 21 scientific studies that show that DECA degrades to more toxic forms.
Thank you. And Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point of clarification because I'm a little confused. Did the firefighters actually go on record as saying that they wanted to be protected because of this? I don't recall if they really took a position that strong.
Representative Clark.
No, Mr. Chairman, the firefighters at this point are neutral. And I talked to them as of today, and they're still gathering their information. They're not opposed to the bill. They're not supportive of the bill.
And I thought just in relation to that, in Washington State, was there not support among the firefighter community for a similar ban?
There was. The International Association of Firefighters did send a letter to Washington State supporting their bill, which is very similar to this one, very few differences. I have not received that kind of letter yet. You know, hopefully at some point we might get that, but at this point I have not yet received it. I've asked for it. We hopefully have it by the next time we need to talk about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. The only reason I really asked that, I was a little confused. I'm not an expert on either one of these on either side of this testimony, and I was a little skeptical on either side, and I wasn't quite sure if the firefighters came on record somewhere stronger than I thought they did or not. But they did internet by in the state of Washington, you said.
It was the International Association of Firefighters.
Thank you.
Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olin, as I understand it, the International wrote a letter that has been interpreted as being supportive of this type of bill, but their firefighters, the DEER, tell me that as they read it, it doesn't say that. So I can't tell you as to what any organization that's connected with the fire service that's in support of this. I can tell you lots of them that are saying that they're neutral. Representative Clark, you have is that while you're bringing attention to the potential health hazards of a material that other testimony says cannot even be released from the components that it's embedded in, I am concerned about taking this out of the market with regard to its fire protection, because I know that it's used, even from your own documents here, it's used in mattresses and drapes and different types of areas where, boy, when I was fighting fires, and I was a professional firefighter 27 years, and we had a lot of problems with those types of materials. We don't have nearly the same level of concern today as we did then, and I believe it's because of some of the retardant manufacturing processes that are employed. What assurance do we have that this is not going to, banning this material will not give us hazardous components back in our homes again that would actually be threatening lives and firefighters and others? I don't have evidence either way, and I'm wondering what assurance you can give me that this would not be a step that would provide alternatives, that maybe those alternatives are not compatible to the materials or not affordable or, you know, wouldn't be used because not everything is put into standards. So I appreciate some comments along those lines.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Osmond. One of the things that we do say in the bill is that if there is not an alternative, there can be an appeal, you know, to try to look at other alternatives. But the fact is that there are plenty of alternatives. And if you just look again at the document that we provided, I really took very seriously the question, like, what are the alternatives? We want to know. And that's why you have that document before you that has all the alternatives listed. And I guess what we really are concerned about is just these products in household dust. That's the main place where people are getting contaminated, in their households. And so, you know, we're very, very, very interested. I'm certainly very interested in protecting our homes from fires, and I'm protecting our firefighters who are trying to protect our homes. So I guess the assurance I can give you is to say that we know that there's alternatives. I've placed the document here before you that lists some of those and goes through them and the most common products where we're concerned about it. It's already been phased. Some of these have already been phased out. This is not a new idea only in Minnesota. It's happening. It's happened in Europe. It's happened in many parts of our states for some parts of these PBDEs. And the one that we're concerned about is that we do not want to see more manufacturers stepping up to use the DECA. Since there are alternatives, we just don't want more of that appearing in our homes and showing up in household dust and having our children breathing it and ending up with some of the issues that they end up with, the neurotoxin, reproductive hazard, and as you certainly would care, if firefighters have to go into those homes and fight fires, then they are going to be exposed, as has been admitted, by this product being broken down in incineration by fire. So I guess my best reassurance is to say to you, there, since there's alternatives, why don't we be cautious and use those alternatives?
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hoppe.
I won't belabor the point, but I mean, we had what on the surface looked like a no-brainer that everyone was going to support bill last time, and it was contentious. There were both sides making what I thought were pretty good arguments, and I didn't really know where the truth was. We continued the bill. Now we're having it, and basically we're getting the expert opinion only from one side, and we're going to go ahead and make the decision and pass this bill out of here. And I think that there, yeah, we want to get these things out of the atmosphere. We don't want the dust in the houses, but I think that there were at least some serious concerns raised during the last committee hearing. And I guess it's just, you know, we all know it's going to pass, but it's just, you know, the fact that we're doing it and now hearing only one side of it is somewhat troubling. And I, Representative Clark, I hope you do get together with the industry people, and if you can't achieve peace in the valley, at least, you know, try to at least work with them.
Mr. Chairman, I'm always,
yes,
willing to, willing to work with, you know, whoever has a concern on these issues, of course.
And I do think that there has been ample opportunity to ask questions from both sides, both last week and this week, if people so choose. Mr. Mackey's been able to step forward and answer questions as well. Any other questions? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, regarding the materials that you've handed out, if you could help me make sure I'm looking at the right thing. I know that the testimony the other day said that there was two types of fire retardants that are essentially not used in the industry. The third that you're most concerned about was the DECA material, because that's still being in use. The Minnesota Public Health Association resolution that you have before you, is that referring to the DECA material? Is it, it lists it as a PBDE, and I see the only place I see a P in front of BDE is Penta, and I think that was one of those that's no longer used.
No, it's referring to all the whole family compounds. Penta, DECA, and ACA. Actually, I'm looking for my document of that so I can refer you so I can see it, but I maybe pass them all out to you. Public health. Oh, thank you. Okay. So let's talk about the whole family of PBDEs, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. And what we're talking about here is the number of bromine atoms on the compound. That means we have three different versions.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Representative Maliani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I'm just looking at the bill. We haven't really talked about the language in the bill, which is okay. It's important for us to understand the science and the arguments around that. But I'm noticing at the end of the bill that you have an exemption part here that calls for a three-year exemption. It's actually renewable for specific use of commercial DECA ether. I'm not going to say the whole name because I can't pronounce it. It sounds to me like, Representative Clark, that you're trying to strike some kind of a balance here in terms of allowing for enough time for us to be able to gather information in the state, really get our heads around the constantly emerging research, but also buying some time for those in the commercial and who are currently using this element to be able to have to be able to buy some time there. I think I'm reading that right. Is that what you're attempting to do? I mean, it seems to me that this if that's so, that in many ways you really have a moderate I think responsible approach that does attempt to address Representative Hoppe's to some degree, I think, desire to see some level of peace of the valley here in terms of balancing out some interests. I hope I'm not reading more into here than I should, but I just wanted to comment on that and allow you a brief opportunity to comment on that language.
Thank you for pointing that out. And actually, I think last time I did talk about what a moderate bill I thought this was, because we are phasing out. We are asking the commissioner every 2 years to come back and talk to us about whether or not they're finding the feasibility alternative, any new evidence, to make recommendations to us, to continue to be involved with this issue. This isn't, you know, the only effort we're going to have with this particular piece of legislation. So thank you for pointing that out. I do need to make one small amendment, Mr. Chairman. I almost forgot. I did talk with the Department of Administration today. And now if we're working off the old bill, it would be 3.12 on that line, 3.12. I would like to add before the phrase "or private party," I'd just like to add the word "or public entity." Those two words, those three words. And that is to ensure, that, again, that the used materials that the state is trying to sell or, you know, recycle can also take advantage of the exemption for used properties. Yeah. And that was brought to my attention, so I'm happy to do that. So if someone would move that, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. Could you repeat that again, the amendment?
Yes. On line 3.12, before or after the word charity and before the word or, if you could just include public entities. I think it's two words. Comma.
Okay. I will move Representative Park's amendment, oral amendment, that on line 3.12, we insert the words public entities between charity and or, public entities, comma. Everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Clark, any further comments?
No, I just appreciate the members' very thoughtful consideration of this. And I do think that one of the things that we are trying to point out here is that we don't need to choose between toxic flame retardants and public health. There is a way to work on this that protects both.
Seeing no further questions, I will renew the motion that House File 934, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Amendment is, or the bill is passed as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next, we have Representative Peterson, House File 589. And while testifiers are coming down, I will move House File 589 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. Welcome to the committee, Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This bill is House File 589. I believe there's a handout coming around, hopefully, that says Next Generation Biofuels Legislation on it as we move here today. Before we get into the bill itself, I just want to point out that to the committee that a lot of people that I run into make general statements about the support of energy independence in the United States and our ability to fix the addiction to fossil fuels, if you will. And just for the record and the timing of today's hearing, that the President of the United States is in Brazil today, making potential arrangements for the development of imports into America on sugar cane ethanol from Brazil. That I don't know how much that would help our energy independence, if you will, and our local economy in Minnesota for fuel in the future from non-fossil sources. So some are aware of this bill and the biofuels and the bioenergy components in it, and some may not be. But I think that it is not necessarily a time to be cautious on advancing biofuels and bioenergy. And this bill might not be the perfect bill for solving, I guess, what could be a lot missed opportunity if we lose our market to Brazil and other countries. But I just wanted to note that today for the record that this is occurring as we're speaking. So the bill in front of us today, since it's a policy committee, but it's open for everything in honesty, is the major components. The one is creation of a clean energy program out of the Reinvest in Minnesota program that we have in the state of Minnesota. And by providing the incentives to farmers to grow the native perennial plants for fuel and energy, and establishment of a technical committee standards and monitoring, which would need to occur, obviously, before any bonding would go out for this purpose. The bill also creates a revolving loan fund for capital investments by farmers and others involved with growing the perennial plants for energy or seed. And the incentives, like similar to what has occurred in corn ethanol in the state of Minnesota, there's a production incentives for biofuels and for bioenergy. So for the bioenergy, it's in a couple tiers, as it is for biofuels, tiers 1 and 2. For the bioenergy, you know, you're going to get a 75 cents per million BTUs for energy produced from ag cellulose sources such as corn, stover, wheat straw, beet pulp, etc. You know, for about 3 years by 2009 if you're operating. And tier two would be $1.50 per million BTUs generated from cellulose materials that are what you say non-ag residue, but the grasses, if you will. And into the biofuels production, it's similar. Well, secondly, you'd receive that for 10 years for tier two bioenergy. For biofuels, it would be what is tier one, 15 cents a gallon from those cellulose materials from grown on agricultural lands for 5 years. And tier two would be 30 cents a gallon for the grasses, if you will, from the RIM clean energy acres and bonding for 10 years. And what is important to note in this bill, at least in my opinion, is that it has a strong recognition of the benefits of local ownership, farmer ownership, and local community ownership of the facilities, the manufacturing, the feedstock, the vendors, the industry, if you will, similar to the Minnesota model on corn ethanol. And it sets also a biofuels target. We have a biofuels target in the state, 20% E20, and we have E85 expansion desire. That one quarter of the existing state renewable fuel standard for cellulose biofuels by 2015, or when 60 million gallons are produced in the state annually. There's some appropriations, yet the bonding amount, which would have to be set up maybe not this year, but after the technical committee at the Board of Water and Soil Resources addresses it, would be $20 million of bonding. And then the $3.5 million, which is bond bill to create the program, the guidelines, and the easement sign-ups. And then going down the grants for research and monitoring, and then out of the finance, the creating the revolving loan fund, and then to the Pollution Control Agency for permitting and of the emerging technology, and to the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, farm-scale demonstration, research and outreach, AURI, Ag Utilization Research Institute, technical assistance, and then grants to non-governmental organizations to assist the communities in developing some facilities. And then the production incentives are capped annually. You probably can see the number there. So what we're looking at is about 10,000 acres. If you got $20,000, $20 million in bonding, you could, I think, get to, depending on the payment rate and such, but the rough estimate is about 10,000 acres of land. Now, there is a desire with the tiers. If you're not familiar with why the tier one, tier two type of mechanism is being proposed, is that in the federal government, there's a conservation security program which awards payments based on how many conservation practices you're engaged in. So it would be an attempt here to be in congruent, not staggered from the federal behavior. And then there's also been statements made by Congressman Peterson, who has indicated, as he writes the next farm bill, that he's interested in an energy title of about 5 million acres producing domestic energy from sources. Now, on the bioenergy side, the gasification, there's the fuel side, the liquid side of this, the sugar side, the enzyme side, the sugar platform, whatever you want to call it, and then there's the gasification side, the thermal side. Thermal side is running a couple places in Little Falls at the ethanol plant, which primarily wood, and then in Benson, in my legislative district in Swift County, with more of the crop residue and such, and testing of which feedstock will be the best one to use. Now, if you're interested in CO2 reduction or emissions reduction, for example, if you're making corn ethanol burning coal, you're not reducing your CO2. If you're making corn ethanol burning natural gas, you decrease your CO2 emissions 20%. If you're making corn ethanol by gasifying biomass, you're reducing another 50% your CO2. And if you're actually making the cellulose ethanol liquid, the liquid fuel, you're decreasing your CO2 footprint 80%, meaning that you could then wager or think about a low carbon fuel that might be able to enjoy a price premium in states that have CO2 emission reduction goals, standards, or targets similar to those being developed in California. And then the idea is potentially you could get paid more for a cellulose fuel created by either bioenergy fueling, increasing the energy balance in the positive direction on corn ethanol production, which sometimes we hear a little bit of banter about how corn ethanol is not sustainable, it uses too much energy and such, even though it currently does have a positive energy balance. You could have a more positive energy balance if you replace that part of the histogram where it goes down from the 60% of that input cost that's coming from natural gas, as we've seen from Dr. Tillman's presentation. So that's just something that the committee should think about. We have been through many committees, and we appreciate your positive support of this bill today so we can go to the next committees. Now, the money part is in here, but the targets haven't been set, as members know. So that is going to be adapted and switched around with the finance chairs, as we all know. So it's not just set just yet. It might not be just the perfect bill, but it is a work in progress, and many people, I can tell you, are interested in it. And I'll move then now to the testifiers today, and he can introduce himself, and we can go from there.
Yes, and welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Dr. Clarence Lehman, faculty member in the Department of Ecology at the University of Minnesota, and I'm one of the authors on this recent science paper on carbon-negative biofuels, along with Regents Professor David Tillman and Dr. Jason Hill. And I can get some broad theoretical background on the science behind this diverse prairie fuel idea. I worked at Cedar Creek Natural History Area at the university during the time this science was being discovered. And I also have some practical experience in prairie restoration on my own lands in north central Minnesota for 20 years now. And then I conduct their scientific experiments to learn what the best way to do to restore prairie in that area is. I would say that there are really two reasons for biofuels. The first is energy security, dependence on Mideast oil, reducing that. The second could be called climatic security. There are big global climate implications, of course, for the increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but there are big implications for Minnesota, too. Our state is special in many ways, but one way it's special is because we are the triple meeting point here of the three great ecosystems of North America. Here, the needle-leaf forests come from the north and stop here. The deciduous forests come from the west, east and stop here, and the prairies come from the Rockies and stop in Minnesota. If this triple ecotone, triple meeting point of the three great ecosystems of North America. But according to my calculations, using the United States Historical Climate Network weather stations, about 20 years ago, this triple meeting point started moving north. It's been in Minnesota for thousands of years, but it started moving north a few miles a year. And if it continues at its present rate, and we don't know that it will, but under global warming, that's the direction. If it continues at its present rate for the next 70 years, it will depart Minnesota for Canada, and the pines of Minnesota will be no more. But that doesn't have to be, you see. If we and the rest of the world act now, Minnesota is in a good position to do our part of reversing this global trend, and we can set examples for others to follow. And we do know what to do, by the way. There are at least 16 known technologies, any 7 of which will stop the increase in carbon dioxide worldwide. There's no silver bullet, but there is a buckshot load of silver pellets, about 16 pellets, and we only have to have 7 of them hit the target. And so, for example, one of the pellets is over 50 years to increase fuel mileage on all cars from 30 miles to gallon to 60 miles to gallon. That solves 1/7 of the world's energy problems. Biofuel is another 1/7. And it's well in Minnesota and elsewhere to develop more than one kind of renewable energy. All forms of biofuel, from corn to soybeans to wood, provide some basic benefits like reduced oil and coal use, local availability, keeping money in the local circulation. The long-term research at the university shows biofuel from diverse restored prairies has some additional benefits. First of all, these kinds of biofuels can grow on degraded farmlands that are now not in production. And ultimately, over the course of time, they restore those farmlands to fertility. These biofuels need little input, no nitrogen fertilizer, no annual herbicides. They produce more biomass than simple combinations of species under similar conditions, and they produce more consistent yields from year to year. That's important for biofuel. They are much better at cleansing groundwater of pollutants like nitrates. And then there are other benefits. For properly done, there are benefits for wildlife and for humans. A savanna-type biofuel plantation actually looks more like a park than an agricultural area. The amount of energy that we calculate appears to be enormous, really. It can be used in a number of ways. For example, it could be used, burned directly in pellet stoves. That's fairly easily. And the pellet stoves, in the not-so-distant future, will be able to generate their own electricity locally. It could be used to supply the process heat in corn ethanol plants, thereby making corn ethanol much more efficient. It can be coal-fired with coal in coal plants, and that will reduce the coal plant's carbon footprint. And here's an interesting example. The Big Stone Power Plant, the proposed new Big Stone Power Plant, happens to be at the center of a biodiversity hotspot in Minnesota. And it could get 100 megawatts of its power from local biofuel on degraded farmland. And combining this with what I think is the idea of the century, carbon capture and storage from biofuel, that whole power plant could conceivably become carbon neutral or carbon negative. Finally, a prairie biofuel being converted directly to liquid fuels by digestive or combustive methods, and that, of course, needs further investigation. But there is this chicken and egg situation where the farmers won't naturally start producing the material until there's a market, and the market won't naturally develop until there's material. So that's where legislation must help. I leave you with this seemingly paradoxical but nonetheless true statement about prairie biofuel. Burning 1 ton of coal adds 3 tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But burning 1 ton of prairie biofuel grown on restored prairie on degraded farmland actually removes 1 ton of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That's seems strange, but it's very important, globally important property of these perennial biofuels.
Thank you, Dr. Lehman. And we have next
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening, members. With me today is Don Arnosti from Clean Energy Minnesota to make a short presentation and then be here for questions. Thank you for your time.
And Mr. Arnosti, welcome. If you could state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Arnosti. I work with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and we are one of the 13 member organizations of Clean Energy Minnesota. I'm representing the Coalition of Clean Energy Minnesota today. I thank you for your time and attention to this issue. I think I'd like to just pick up on a few comments that were made both by Representative Peterson and Dr. Lehman to help you set the stage and understand what's happening here. Representative Peterson mentioned that the President and a number of other people are viewing biofuels as a world trade opportunity. And it's clear that there are many people that are taking a look at our energy appetite and thinking that we would be benefited from shifting it from the Middle East or other countries where we gain our fossil fuels right now to a renewable fuel source that perhaps would be imported from more friendly countries. I think that would be missing a great opportunity, and what our bill is trying to do is capture that. For example, Europe a couple of years ago passed a biodiesel mandate, partly in their desire to develop renewable fuels, partly in their desire to reduce their carbon footprint, and the result was almost immediate that the Malaysian rainforest started being bulldozed and cut down for oil palm plantations, so that the oil could be raised in former rainforest areas to be manufactured into biodiesel and imported into Europe. This, in these days of global trade and knowledge about markets and all that, it happened literally almost instantaneously in a matter of a year or two, to the chagrin of many of the people who mandated and desired the biodiesel, such that Europe has put a hold on some of those things. We don't want to be in the same position in this country. Yet we have a tendency to, as a culture, I would say, to say ready, fire, aim. And what we're doing right now is there is a great rush to biofuels. The President's busy hawking the market that isn't quite there yet and hopefully signing up a trade deal from his point of view that probably will result in rainforest destruction and other things that are very negative from an environmental and a global carbon emissions perspective and certainly would not benefit Minnesota's local economy, our waters, our people, and that sort of thing, much less, as Representative Peterson said, do anything for energy independence. What you have before you today, I think, is an opportunity to recognize that there's an idea afoot that is around the globe that we need to develop bioenergy and biofuels and alternative non-fossil fuel sources. And this is an attempt to take the best science and the best thinking, some of which has been done right here by the University of Minnesota and has been worked on over the last 10 or 20 years, invested in by you folks with taxpayer dollars, and put in place a Minnesota model, much like Minnesota did a dozen or 14 years ago with the first generation of biofuels. And this Minnesota model, we believe, is trying to learn from that first generation and improve upon it to incorporate not only the need for clean energy and reduction in carbon emissions, but also to take into account our immediate need now and in the long-term future to clean up our waters and to establish wildlife habitat, restore wetlands and other lost water areas on our agricultural landscape. It's an opportunity to bring together the constituencies of farmers and sports people who enjoy the great outdoors and to understand that it's not about maximum production agriculture or conservation set-asides, which frankly are the two agricultural landscape models that we have today. We have the RIM program, the CRP program, CREP program, which are set-aside programs designed to mitigate some of the impacts of annual intensive agriculture production, and then we have annual intensive agricultural production supported by the Federal Farm Bill. This bill is a third way, a Minnesota way. It's a small start, as Representative Peterson said. The $20 million in bonding that is proposed would probably directly impact 10,000 acres and work with farmers controlling 10,000 acres, but it's also designed to set in place incentives and to tease and coax and cajole this potentially runaway idea of biofuels into something that is truly sustainable and beneficial for local economies and the people of Minnesota today and in the future. So we would ask you to take a look at this bill in this way, and I think what I would say is the perfect is the enemy of the practical, And I think what we have here is a practical attempt to put in place a much preferred model to leveling the rainforest and importing our biofuels from Brazil, for example, or some of the other ideas that might be out there. And we would ask, you know, for your thought, your input, and work with us as we work to improve this Minnesota model and show that there may be another way that we can do it that is of benefit both the local communities, our environment, and our long-term energy security. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aronofsky. Are there any questions? Representative Lagunias.
Not a question, because I'm a supporter. So it's just a note that I've been reading your definitions of native prairies, and I introduced a bill today with definitions, too. They don't conflict, but I think maybe as we go along, I'd like to coordinate them a little, because DNR has given us a map of ecoregions in the state, and there is a way to put that into statute. So I'd like to work with you as we go forward on that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Gaines, thank you for paying attention to the bill, and I appreciate your input. I'm definitely willing to not just do it twice, but maybe do it once with the resources that the state might appropriate to address and formally implement this idea. So I'm glad Representative Gaines is willing to help the effort.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I think the bill is a good start. I have a couple questions. Just one, it's not your intent that, you know, if this is successful 10 years from now, we don't drive through the country and see heavily irrigated, intensively fertilized, manicured plots or fields of native prairie that have been turned into a commodity like any other one. Okay. Your intent is that it would be as it is now and not what I just described.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Hansen. I believe Dr. Lehman made clear some of the opportunities on the acres that we would be talking about here. No, my intent would not be to develop a field the size of my legislative district for just one thing. But realizing that this can be done in a way to maximize the water quality and to the efforts on the clean water legacy, the hunting and access and the creation of habitat, if you will, in consultation with the Department of Natural Resources, using an existing program for the RIM style type lands, which I know you're familiar with. And but there is a little bit of a, you know, for full disclosure, there's a little bit of, you know, development that needs to be done still on the enzyme side of the cellulose ethanol fuel. Is that from what I've read, and maybe I hope, you know, maybe others have opinions, is that the machine doesn't necessarily want to deal with 32 different species of grass just right now, but the gasification side doesn't seem to care. We need to find out which one maximizes the energy balance to its maximum extent, and go with that one. This bill sets up that development. It doesn't pick. It doesn't say that we're going to have one big field of switchgrass in western Minnesota. Because if you're from the rural part of the state and you realize that all prairie is not equal, and a lot of prairie is not left anymore. You know, there were 25 million acres of tallgrass prairie once upon a time, and there's less than 1% left. You know, so the prairie, you know, closer to Cedar Creek is a lot different than it is in Lincoln County. You know, the difference between the short grass prairie, the mixed grass prairie, and the tall grass prairie, it all kind of comes together right around the border of Minnesota and South Dakota. So thank you. No, to answer your question, I'm with you.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, the way the prairie is now, it provides a lot of wildlife habitat, and I would like to work with you before the next stop or the next committee on trying to maybe get some language on minimizing impacts during harvesting on wildlife habitat, timing or some comfort language there, I think, for some members on trying to, as this process moves forward, doing a little protection of wildlife habitat.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I know that DNR has just employed a person to address some of the things in this bill. So it is being done formally. So I think you'll be consulted with.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I've been looking through this bill and discussing it with my neighboring members here. I can't find anywhere in here that it includes woody biomass for any of the incentives or any part of this program.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dill. I knew you would ask that today.
How did you know
that? Not just because of wood. Because your district is three times the size of mine and it's full of trees.
Well, when you start passing out 30 cents a gallon, I'd like to get in line for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dill. We've had a stakeholder meeting earlier today where that has been brought up, and it's definitely something that will be considered as it goes through the next couple committees. I appreciate your input and any formal ideas you have on the matter.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dill.
Well, I know that there are, Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, I know that there are projects that are in the wings, at least in the pilot stages, and I know that there is still technology advances that need to be made to make the technology workable and feasible in terms of, you mentioned earlier, the enzymes that they use to break down to get the sugar away from the whatever they do. And I just felt like, this would be, otherwise it's going to compel us to have another bill that is almost identical to this, except that deals with wood. And it's my thinking that, unless you can be convinced otherwise, that we probably should take a crack at this for the whole state and all of the opportunities. And it seems to me that in the pictures that and I'm not saying that using prairie grass isn't a wonderful thing for sequestering carbon and for making ethanol, ultimately. But in the pictures I saw of places where they were proposing to grow the crop, that the crop that you're referring to wasn't the type of grass prairie that we have in Minnesota. It was a crop that was extremely dense and 6 to 7 to 8 feet tall. And so I'm not criticizing that. That's not my point. But I'm just saying that I think we got a long way to go in all of that. I'd like to see woody biomass included. We have just an abundance of that stuff that we can't use in the pulp and paper industry and in the sawmill industry, and it's I think this has great potential.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Arnosti.
Chairman and Representative Dill, part of the reason being some of the organizations that were helping to craft this bill, part of the reason that we focused this bill on the agricultural region of the state, there's several. One is in terms of the national and international pressure, it's being viewed as an opportunity to raise and cultivate and do kind of agricultural development of the biofuels. So we wanted to be in front of that and to have the state, put its, call it sustainability stamp on how can we do this in a way that really is beneficial locally from all levels. And given that there are limited resources, we were focusing on that. A second thought in terms of the discussion about woody biomass, we felt that actually the development of conversion technology for woody biomass to energy is further along in this state and in other places in the woody side than it is in the agricultural side. And I'll give you an example. We essentially have 8 or 10 different biomass energy plants, some in your district and others scattered in northern Minnesota, and they're using what I describe as, well, I described sort of three phases of technology. Yesterday's technology, which is to burn
biomass material to generate energy. Today's technology, which is to gasify it and create a synthetic natural gas, it's here today and it's being worked on and the kinks are being worked out. And tomorrow's technology, which is to use enzymes, for example, to convert whether it's wood or prairie grasses. Well, yesterday's technology, not to cast aspersions at it, but we have a lot of examples of woody biomass energy facilities using yesterday's technology, good technology. But there's actually a lot of things that need to be worked out on the research end and the R&D end for the infrastructure that's already in place. So, for example, the Blandin paper plant has a power facility run by Minnesota Power. It's referred to as Blandin, as UPM Kimmy, but the Grand Rapids plant. They've been buying woody biomass for energy for several years right now to supplement what they've been producing off of their existing wood material. And there's a lot that could be learned about gathering that material, doing it in an effective and efficient manner. And so we're feeling like the need to spark additional conversion facilities in the forested part of the state is not the same as we have in the agricultural part. Instead, we need to work with existing biomass energy facilities in the forested part of the state to make sure that we're providing technology transfer, R&D, and basically maximizing the opportunities that are already there and not overbuilding the conversion resource and maybe overrunning the available wood supply. Anyway, those are all part of the reasons why this bill was focused on agriculture initially. But we'd love to work with you about some of the needs of the, you know, the woody conversion facilities.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point. Well, I just think that when we start creating a new loan or subsidy program that, there are projects that are using the new technology or the coming technology. And the other thing is I want to make sure that we don't send a message that just because it happens to be up close to the boundary waters that we don't want any ethanol plants up there just because we happen to be within the gunshot of the boundary waters.
Sure.
Because I've heard around this building, there are a lot of things I've heard around this building. Most of them not accurate. But I've heard that one of the reasons it's not in this bill is because that environmental organizations don't want to see more industrial activity up close to the boundary waters or even in northeastern Minnesota. That doesn't play with us.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that that's the real reason, but we better be getting wood in there. That's my suggestion.
Well, and I agree that we need to be looking at all the different biomass materials available. I know Dr. Lehman had referred to the fact that we're unique and that we have the three biomes all coming together, and I just thought I'd remind people that they happen to come together in my district, so maybe we can look at some experiment stations up there. But anyway, we do have two more bills, and there's three more people that have questions, so I'd like to try to wrap it up after that with the questioning and then move on. We have next Representative Lagunias.
Thank you. Well, this is going to be hard to be a quick question, but I hope Dr. Lehman can help us with it. Some of us who are your best supporters have been discussing how long it takes to restore a prairie. Take a degraded piece of cropland and just take us through the process, and not in a length, but take us through so we have a better time frame, because we sometimes come up with different timelines.
Well, here's my experience, that when I did it on my own personal property up in north central Minnesota, first of all, each time we did it, we learned something and improved it. There's a lot that still can be learned about this. The typical rule of thumb would say, if you throw out the seed, you prepare the land and throw out the seed, and come back in 3 years or four, and then you'll have a nice prairie. Now, there are ways that can be speeded up, I think. At Cedar Creek, it came up much faster. We had a much cleaner seed bed. So the basic idea, though, is that the basic thing that people observe is when you plant a prairie, the first year you mow it to let the light get down to the prairie. Well, the prairie for the first few years puts down roots, deep roots. The ordinary weeds are growing above ground and not investing in roots. The prairie puts down roots and not much above ground. But after 3 years or 4 years, then the prairie starts growing above ground and then kills the weeds. the thistles and they're all the little weeds that are in a prairie in the early years, as in any agricultural field, they vanish in many places after 4 years. Now, there's biofuel available during those first few years. The total productivity of the prairie continues to increase with time. And the more diverse the prairie is, the more the increase continues.
Can I just have a question? So for good production, what are you thinking? 5 years, 6 years, 7 years? What is
it? It can look very nice after 3 years. I had some beautiful prairies myself after 3 years, and at Cedar Creek we had nice after 3 years. The productivity does continue to build, but after 4 years it's pretty much a real, it looks like like a real prairie.
Thank you.
And Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need to ask a blunt question for someone who's not on the agriculture community. I'm enthusiastic about the next generation of biofuels, but I guess I have a question about the old generation of biofuels. And are we going to do anything as we go to the next generation to create disincentives for the stuff that we feel was good to start with but is not as friendly as non-corn-based ethanol? And are we differentiating in a subsidy structure between ethanol that's going to be fired up with coal versus something else? I guess I'm looking to see if we're going to get rid of something before, as we get into something new from a fiscal standpoint.
Mr. Nosky.
Chairman, Representative Gardner. I think what you're referring to is the existing corn ethanol industry. And what our bill does is actually incentivize the transformation initially of their fuel source, which is sort of the low-hanging fruit. There's opportunities in here for existing corn ethanol facilities to switch from fossil fuels to biomass as a fuel, a process fuel. And that's, again, they can use yesterday's and today's technology, you know, the burning and the gasification, which we don't need to wait for it to be proved out. They need a little assistance to begin to install these facilities. And two ethanol facilities, corn ethanol facilities in Minnesota, are in the process of doing that right now. The second thing is it would incentivize those facilities, and it is certainly possible. You don't have to close down a corn ethanol facility to begin to produce cellulosic ethanol at it. There would be an additional processing step that would have to come ahead of their current processing steps, but these facilities could be retrofitted to begin to take in biomass as it becomes available locally, and the incentives are there for them to do that. So we'd love to see the transformation as rapidly as possible of those facilities from corn feedstocks to other feedstocks, but initially they can just change their energy source.
And Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for the author. This bill will be going eventually to the Ag Finance Committee, is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, the next one, if it gets out of here today, is to go to Ag Policy. Then, yes, the answer is yes.
So it comes out of the Ag Finance Budget and that Environment Natural Resource
question,
correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, it would have parts of both.
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, then to Representative Gill's point and question, I would say that if this bill is coming out of Environment Natural Resource Finance Committee, I think that there is a strong argument that could be made that it should include woody biomass, and because of the statewide nature of it. Otherwise, and all due respect to the author, I'm guessing that Representative Bill and I would probably author a similar bill that would also go to that same budget and compete for those funds.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, I've been looking at bill introductions and wondering why you haven't yet.
We'll get on it tonight.
Thank you. I just walked right into that. Thank you.
The alternative, Representative Peterson, would be to work with you on this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative White, I appreciate that even more.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. And Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have peace in the valley here. I think that's what we're getting. And let's go ahead and pass this, and you guys can work this out, and we'll go elect some regents.
And Representative Gelt.
Well, did I hear Representative Moe's? Is this going to go through Representative Guineas ultimately as well?
That's what Representative
Guineas said. We were all three discussing how to give it to you, but so I didn't hear exactly what you said.
Yeah, Mr. Representative Gelt, yes, that is what the path is, if it gets out of here before we vote on the regents.
Okay, thank you. Sorry I missed that.
Seeing no other questions, I will renew the motion that House File 589 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. And next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Peterson.
As the chair moves towards the testifying area, I'd note that we have about 10 minutes left. And we've got a number of people notice the chair's bill, too.
Oh, is it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I would like to move House File 1666 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. And I also have a couple of amendments here. Actually, it's one amendment, a couple of changes in it. And that would be H1666A1. And I would also move that amendment.
Eakin moves amendment H1666A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what we have before us today is a bill for a study. It's a bill that would authorize $475,000 to fund studies and other activities related to terrestrial and geologic carbon sequestration, which is the capture and storage of atmospheric CO2 in plants and soils and also in deep geologic formations. There are multiple benefits to such processes, and it's already been referred to in part in previous testimony given here tonight. But this study would help the state define sequestration approaches. It would be valuable in guiding our future policies and also private investments in the area of sequestration. The bill will fund the collection and analysis of needed information about sequestration, and Representative Dill, you'll appreciate this, in Minnesota forests, also in agricultural lands, in wetlands, and in prairies. And it also funds analysis of public and private programs and the development of recommendations to the legislature on future policy needs. These studies and other outreach and educational activities will be coordinated through the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. And this is really, it's a task force of government stakeholders, university representatives that are based at the University of Minnesota, and there are a number of different stakeholders that are involved here. All the participants that would be affected and that have expertise and knowledge in these areas would be involved in these studies. It would fund the preliminary study also for the Minnesota Geologic Survey to determine
whether further analysis in geologic formations in Minnesota is warranted. And the geologic sequestration is different from terrestrial in that it's not storing it in plants in the ground or in the soil. It's actually capturing carbon from plants and storing it in the ground. And one of the areas they're looking at is in southeast Minnesota. It's kind of based on some studies that have already been done in Wisconsin, where they have discovered areas that would have a great capacity for the potential of this capture and sequestration of carbon in the ground. And we have similar geologic formations in the southeast part of Minnesota, so that's an area that is being looked at. One thing about these other studies, I mentioned that Wisconsin's already done some studies. Many other states have been doing studies in this area, and many other states are way out ahead of us on this issue. One of the good things is that we don't have to start at ground zero. We can actually take from the studies that other states have done and build on that. And even though other studies have been done in these states, we can't adopt them wholesale because, of course, we have a different climate, we have different plants, we have different soils, so we have to look at all that in order to make any kind of plan and programs fit here in our state. What this will really do is it's going to provide a suite of different options for the state of Minnesota. We really need this knowledge and information before we can move ahead effectively with programs like the ones that were in Representative Peterson's bill, for instance. And given some of the legislation that's moved forward, including the renewable energy standards and also some of the legislation that's currently moving through the legislative process, like the Global Mitigation Act or Global Warming Mitigation Act, this information would be critical in the success of such legislation in the future. I would also, in closing, just want to once again talk about some of the multiple benefits to especially the terrestrial sequestration, the planting of perennial grasses, for instance. The benefits are numerous, and this again will enable us to do carbon sequestration and place these plants in the most beneficial areas that will have the greatest impact. Many of the multiple benefits include not just the sequestration of carbon, but also it includes flood mitigation, it includes cleaner waters, it includes the use of less pesticides and things of that sort. It includes the possibility of energy production from these grasses, and it includes habitat. So there are numerous benefits to be had, and so it's time for us to start the process. And before we can implement anything on the ground, we really need to first study things, make sure we're going down the right path so that we spend our public resources in the most effective and efficient way possible. So with that, I'd like to introduce the testifiers that I have with me today. First of all, we have Cheryl Miller, who will be testifying on the bill and is the coordinator for the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative, who was involved in putting this legislation together. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Representative.
Ms. Miller, I want to be really mindful of the time. Could you state your name for the record?
Cheryl Miller. And I'm the coordinator of the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. And I guess I could most efficiently just go through the bill. Would that be the...
Mr. Chair? I've read the bill and I'm fully informed.
Is this a good bill and should we vote for it? Mr. Grant, is this a good bill and should we vote for it?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Are members fully informed? Representative Tingleston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick comment to the author. I'm looking at line 1.13 and then line 2.19. It talks about the Board of Regents is requested to study. And then on the second page, it talks about the University of Minnesota may contract. I think you may have some consistency issues there, so you might want to look at that as opposed to the next committee.
Thank you, Representative Tingleston.
Representative Eakin, in closing?
It's a good bill. I appreciate your vote.
any further discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Excuse me. Representative Eakin renews his motion that House File 1666, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And Representative De La Forest, I think we may be out of time. Representative De La Forest, if you want to, should we try this?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think we can do it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move, since Representative De La Forest is not on the committee, I'd like to move House File 151.
Representative Hoppe moves House File 151. Representative De La Forest.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, thank you. I believe the destination of the bill would go to the register.
To the register.
That's my understanding. Mindful of the time, Mr. Chairman and members, and not being aware of any opposition to this bill, I can simply tell you what it is. It's a resolution that would express the sense of the legislature that we encourage Congress to reauthorize the CRP program and related programs. As I said, given the time, I'd be happy to stand for any questions or if there's testifiers out there, and I believe there's an amendment. So I'm going to zip it and listen.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the AO70164 amendment, please.
Representative Hoppe moves the
AO164
amendment. And Representative De La Forest, you're aware of the amendment and you're supportive?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. To the bill as amended. Any discussion? Representative Hoppe renews his motion to approve House File 151 as amended and be recommended to pass to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The bill is passed.
Chairman, members, thank you.
Any other further business? Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned.